Tonight on Arena, Carlo Gebler taps into the healing power of fiction in his new book, Tales We Tell Ourselves, and Mark Dooley on curating Abbott Music for Galway 2020. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Carlo Gebler is known as a novelist, biographer, playwright and teacher. His collection of stories, The Wing Orderly's Tales, was inspired by his time teaching in the prisons of Northern Ireland. In 2019, he published a retelling of Aesop's Fable. And this year, he gives us another retelling of a timeless classic. Tales We Tell Ourselves is a selection of stories from the Decameron, a book written by Boccaccio over six centuries ago during the Black Death. With parallels and contrasts to our current crisis, these stories emerge as we adjust to life and loss during COVID-19. And Gebler's central focus, as was Boccaccio's before him, it could be argued, is the fortifying and restorative powers of fiction in the face of tragedy. I'm delighted to have Carlo Gebler join us now on the programme. Start with the Decameron itself, Carlo, if we could. Was Boccaccio's original collection back in the 1300s, written at the time of the Black Death, as I said, which had killed millions, was it about providing some kind of solace for the readers of that period?
Good evening. Absolutely. The book has a sort of framing device, and in the framing device, Boccaccio speaks directly to the reader. The framing device appears at the beginning, all the way through, and at the end, and he talks about the content. He's quite facetious. He talks about it being sort of angled at what he calls the ladies, and help, you know, his intention is to help women. But it's absolutely clear from the way that he's organized the material. The Decameron starts light and ludic and gradually becomes darker and darker and more complicated, that his program was to restore people who had been numbed by the pandemic to restore their feelings back to them. And he also opens the Decameron with an account, a documentary account, which is very like Defoe's documentary account, Journal of the Plague Year, of what the plague to live through was actually like in Florence. And you know from reading this that he's talking about people, a community who are in real trouble.
And the other aspect of this, which is quite interesting in some ways, given the sort of things that are happening at the moment, the 10 young noble people that we find here, 7 young noble women, 3 young noble men, basically form what we might refer to today as a bubble. They take themselves out of the community, out of the difficult situation, off out into the country where they're much safer, and they form this little bubble of their own.
They do. They absolutely form a 2-week bubble. And what happens is that they leave Florence and they go to a villa. In fact, it's 2 villas. And they determine that whilst they're there in the afternoon, when it'll be hot, instead of playing games and becoming fractious, they'll tell each other tales. And the term used by Boccaccio, or by a character through whom Boccaccio is speaking, is that these tales will offer solace and comfort. Solace is the word he uses. And it's absolutely set up, the book sets itself up as an example of people who, in their bubble, use fiction to provide solace to one another.
But it did strike me, you didn't give us, there are 100 tales in total, each of the 10 noble people tells a story every night, there are 10 nights, mm-hmm. hence Decameron. There are 100 tales altogether. You chose 28 from that 100. Were you seeking, Carlo, tales or stories that specifically spoke to a 21st century audience when you culled it in that fashion?
The book, the original Decameron, is 800 pages. I'm a Decanovite. I'm not frightened of hard work, but even I balked at the idea of rewriting 100 stories. So I selected 27 of the stories and then a half story that's told in an aside. And the stories that I picked were stories that seemed to me to be the ones that would most interest us. And they are really surprising. For instance, there's an entertaining Mr. Sloane story It's about a gay man who has married in order to disguise his true sexual orientation, and it doesn't work. And so he and his wife come to an arrangement. They will share their lover at the same time, in the same bed. This is 1350 when this is written. And Boccaccio has, there's no humour, there's no wink, wink, nudge, nudge. He thinks, it is clear from the way he's written it, that this is an absolutely superb solution to a human problem. And his great strength is his sympathy for suffering human beings and the ingenious way in which suffering human beings solve their problems.
The opening story in the book is very interesting in how it deals with, in fact, religious intolerance and preaches a type of religious tolerance. Who's the young man at the heart of this story who, in fact, goes into another story as he tells his story?
There was a tradition of Saladin stories in the medieval period, and Saladin is trying to use shock and awe to force a Jewish banker to give him money for nothing. And he wants to force him to say something disparaging about Islam so that he can then force him to give up his money for free without interest. And the Jewish banker is very, very clever. And he tells a story which illustrates the fact that the three laws, the Judaic law, the Christian law, and the Islam law, who knows which is superior? Only God.
And he does this by way of a kind of a fable, almost going back to your previous, last year's work, Aesop's Fable, a fable around three rings.
Yes, it's about, he tells the story of a king who has three sons, but the son who gets the authentic ring gets everything. And the king tells each of his three sons he'll give them the authentic ring and they'll get everything. And then he thinks, oh my goodness me, I've lied to them. What am I going to do? So he gets an artificer to make a copy, two copies of the original. And when he dies, they each get a ring. Nobody can tell which is the original and which is the facsimile. And the Jewish banker's argument is, and in the same way, no one can tell which is the original and which is the facsimile, Islam, Christianity, or Judaism. They are all equal.
And so
it's ingenious.
Yeah, the three rings provide the solution. Who cares which one is the authentic? If they feel authentic, I suppose, the rings, they are authentic.
The thing is, you can't tell them apart. Once you can't tell something apart, status and hierarchy becomes meaningless.
There are a number of slightly disturbing or problematic, to use that word, stories around the treatment of wives by husbands here, and in fact the treatment of those wives by their lovers who are not the husbands. I'm thinking particularly of a story called The Groom, where it's a young woman married to an older king, but this groom wants to have her, and he doesn't go about it in the most noble of ways.
No, this is one of the most frightening stories. The collection has some extraordinarily harsh things to say about cruelty, power, and the way in which human beings will do terrible things to each other. So the groom learns that the king crosses the chamber and visits his wife in a certain way at a certain time, and he just impersonates the king and passes himself off as the king in order to sleep with the queen. It's an absolutely terrifying story.
Similarly terrifying to me, at any rate, was the judge's wife. Again, a young woman married to an older judge, basically kidnapped by a pirate.
Yeah. But what's interesting about that story is that at the end, Bartoloma chooses not to go back to her husband. She chooses to stay with the pirate.
Again, there are potential problems within that choice. You know, if you're abducted, can you really choose to stay with somebody? Is that a kind of a Stockholm syndrome?
I think that story, you see, one of the other things about this collection is it's an It's a fountain from which all sorts of other stories have flown or flowed. And that story is the source, I would say, for all those sort of abduction happiness stories, best exemplified by the Rudolph Valentino vehicle, the Sheikh. These are not stories about paragons. These are stories about people who do terrible things to each other. I mean, there's another story called A Beating, where a husband, due to his wife's cunning, is beaten very badly by somebody else. He hasn't done anything. Boccaccio was very clear about the fact that people don't always behave properly. And he's also very, very clear that the world is an extremely unequal and unfair place for women. He's also really clear, and this is one of the remarkable things about the appalling facts of the criminal justice system and the customary use of torture in order to extract confession. And this was something that people regarded as perfectly proper in the period, and which he clearly, that's an opinion he derogates from.
And I guess maybe your time spent working in the prisons of Northern Ireland, and we're talking about a different type of incarceration in that case, we should be very clear. But did your time working there make you perhaps more sensitive to those stories from previous times?
Oh, I think so. The criminal justice system is something which largely one only knows about through the newspapers. It's at a remove. It's behind, it all takes place, elsewhere in courtrooms and behind prison walls. But once you get inside, you have your eyes opened and you find out a lot of things. I mean, if working in prison has done anything, it's radicalized me. Socially, it's made me much more skeptical about the way the state or any state functions.
Finally, then, in terms of the stories themselves, do any of Boccaccio's stories, or indeed of the 28 that you've chosen, directly address the whole idea of what was the Black Death, the plague at that time, or COVID-19 for us now? Or is, in fact, the restorative power of the stories the fact that they don't do that?
I think the latter. At the beginning of the original text, there is this documentary description of the plague. And then you have the stories, 100 stories. Not one of them, although they become increasingly local, they feature Italian towns, Italian situations, recent Italian history like the Siege of Faenza. Not one of them mentions the Black Plague once. It's absent. And yet, you know that everything in the original is nested inside that historical calamity.
And you've taken from your lead from Boccaccio in that very act. Carlo Gebler, thanks for speaking to us this evening. Carlo Gebler there speaking to us about his new collection, Tales We Tell Ourselves, a selection from the Decameron. It's published by New Island. This season's Book on One has writers reading their own work. This evening at 20 past 11, Sinead Gleeson reads from Constellations, Reflections on Life. Here's a short excerpt catching the spirit and tone of the book, which tells it straight with regards to living with our physical selves.
In moments of distraction, there's a Kristen Hirsch song that often floats up from the floor of my mind. I've rolled the words back and forth like oars, sung my children to sleep with it. We have hips and makers. We have a good time. They keep me dancing. Finally, it's all right. And it is all right. When there is a day that is pain-free, or the sun shines, or my curious children ask about the lines on my skin, I explain my good luck, grateful that things were not worse. I am an accumulation of all of those sleepless nights and hospital days, of waiting for appointments and wishing I didn't have to keep them, of the raw keel of boredom and self-consciousness that illness is. Without those experiences, I would not be a person who picks up these shards and attempts to reshape them on the page. If I had been spared the complicated bones, I would be someone else entirely. Another self. A different map.
Sinead Gleeson reading from her award-winning book Constellations, Reflections on Life, which is this week's Book on One, runs weeknights here on RTÉ Radio 1 at 20 minutes past 11. Abend Music, which translates as evening music, is the title of a series of vocal and choral music concerts taking place as part of Galway 2020. The first of the five concerts took place in October, and the second of the series takes place this Sunday, November the 22nd at 5 p.m, streamed live from the 700-year-old Church of St. Nicholas in the heart of Galway City. Abend Music presents a programme that includes music by Henry Purcell, George Frederick Handel, and the newly commissioned work from Irish composer Rona Clark. Mark Dooley is curating the concert series, and he joins us now from our Galway studio. Speaking with Carlo Gebler just now, Mark, about the restorative power of fiction in these difficult times, I guess music has a similar restorative power. Was that any kind of a guiding light in the choices of music that you made for this series, for Music for Galway and Galway 2020?
Good evening. Well, sort of serendipitously, it is the texts do speak of music as a source of relief from sorrow and grief. One of the texts that we're singing this Sunday has that line. So yes, I think we can really identify with that and feel that music is taking us out of our current circumstance in a way, lifting us out of it and making us think of greater and higher things.
Yeah, and on the subject of higher things, Sunday's theme is Resounding Landscape. In February, you'll be dealing with Over the Alps. Then later into March, Journey into Twilight, The Way of Sorrow. The landscape theme, how did that inform what you chose for this coming Sunday's concert?
It's one of the Galway 2020 themes, in fact, landscape and migration. You probably sense those two themes running through our concert titles. Mm. And it very much informed the choice of music for this Sunday. The idea of landscape as it's put in one of the texts, vibrating to divinity, the presence of divinity in our world through music, and that landscape is somehow infused with this, or as Hildegard puts it, divinity breathed into being. So that's definitely the sort of thinking behind the construction of our programme this Sunday.
And I suppose the corner piece of the work in many ways is Handel's Dixit Dominus. Just explain the nature of that work to us.
Sure. It's a work by the young Handel. He was living in Rome at the time. I think he was in his early 20s, I think about 22. And he really wanted to make an impact, I think. He had three operas already under his belt and was sort of attuned to the texts that he was setting and what the musical possibilities were. So this psalm, like so many Old Testament texts, is full of sort of violence and drama and blood and guts. It's got lots of wonderful lines in it, from heads being smashed into pieces on rocks to still waters of a flowing brook and all sorts of other things. It's a wonderfully dramatic text. So Handel is responding to this text in the way that he has already done so in his operas, but here in the context of obviously a religious text. It's a wonderfully virtuosic work for both the singers and the players as well. I think it really must have dazzled the Roman public at the time. So it's going to be a wonderful conclusion to our programme.
I want to play a little section of it, perhaps one of the, if maybe less dramatic isn't quite the right word, more reflective, let's put it that way, one of the more reflective sections. This is De Torrente in Via Bibet. What are we talking about? What does that text mean, first of all?
It's the stillness beside the water, basically. So the psalm is one of the royal psalms, so it's about the idea of God as man, king, priest and Messiah. So not only this creature of power and dominance, but also taking time in stillness beside the flowing waters, which is, of course, one of the themes that flows through so many psalms.
And let's have a listen to that section, as I say, more reflective perhaps than the head-bashing sections that you were talking about earlier.
Thank you.
Little section there from Handel's Dixit Dominus, one of the works that will be performed as part of the Music for Galway, Galway 2020 Abend Music event this coming Sunday evening at St. Nicholas's Church in Galway, being live streamed at 5 o'clock on Sunday evening. That recording that we heard there featured the voices of Karine Desai and Natalie Desai, and the choir of the concert Astrea come in a little bit later on. But Mark Dooley, who has curated this series of concerts, is speaking with me this evening. On Sunday evening, it's the Resurgam Choir and the Irish Baroque Orchestra under the direction of Peter Whelan that we will hear. How has that been managed within the church itself? Obviously, it will provide its own atmosphere. Do the singers have to be socially distant? Do the players have to be socially distanced to make this possible?
Yes, they do. So the singers and the players will all be at least 2 metres apart. So we're going to take up a huge amount of space for a relatively small number of performers for a concert like this. We're actually going to be taking up the entire central space of the church, the nave in the middle of the church. So it's a strange thing. I think all ensembles are finding it a very different experience to perform with these huge distances. You haven't got the sense of ensemble in the same way. It's not as easy to hear. But at the same time, you're able to do other things like to develop the sound a little bit more. You have to be listening really, really keenly, much more than you would normally, I think. So it's been a very interesting experience, I think, for everyone to get used to this new sensation. And also to be able to use the buildings in new ways. I mean, we're going to be performing right in the middle of the church, taking up the entire area of where the audience would normally sit. So. Yeah. It's a very different experience all round.
Yeah, and I would guess that the natural resonance of a church space like St. Nicholas's will add a whole new dynamic to the acoustic of what the audience at home will get to hear.
Yes, the challenge is to be able to make them feel as if they're in the building. So what they see and what they hear is as close as possible to the experience of being in the church. But we have a great team of technicians who are hopefully going to wave their magic over their microphones and their cameras on Sunday to make that happen.
The other early composer, or well, he's a Baroque composer like Handel, that we will hear on the night is Henry Purcell. What have you chosen there?
It's one of the odes written by Purcell for the Feast of St. Cecilia, which, as it happens, is falling on Sunday, the 22nd of November, when we're performing this concert.
How fortuitous is that?
Well, yes, serendipity, I think. It's wonderful that we can do the work on this particular day. It was the first of a number of works that Purcell actually wrote for this feast at the behest of the Musical Society of London. And it picks up very much our theme of the landscape vibrating with music, particularly the talents that, as the text puts it, have been lent us by the approving deities, whatever they are, that music is a product of this benevolent, of the benevolent deities. So it chimes very much with this theme of landscape and music vibrating within the landscape.
Let's listen to a little section from the Purcell piece then. This is called Welcome to All the Pleasures.
We celebrate this morning.
Little section there from Welcome to All the Pleasures from Purcell's Ode to St. Cecilia. And Mark Dooley speaking to me this evening about Abbond Music, the series of concerts that he has curated for Music for Galway and Galway 2020. And this Sunday, we'll see a performance of the Purcell piece we've just heard, Handel's Dixit Dominus. But it's not all music from a previous era. There's also a commissioned piece that you have for us from Rona Clark. Tell us a bit about Rona, first of all, Mark, and the piece that she will be having performed on Sunday evening.
Rona Clark has written some marvellous music for choirs. I think many people who sing in choirs will be familiar with her name and may have sung some of her beautifully expressive and sometimes very dramatic settings for choir. So for us, when we were thinking of who we would commission to write our five commissions for the entire series, Rona was an obvious choice in a way. And she has come up with a fantastic text as well, which really chimes with the theme, not just of the concert, but of the whole series.
What is Sunday's text? The title of it.
It's a text by the 12th century mystic and abbess Hildegard of Bingen. Both, not just the text, but also a fragment of the melody that Hildegard wrote for this particular text. The title is O Vis Aeternitatis, which translates broadly as the power of music. The power of eternity. Mm. Well, I suppose you could call it the power of music as well. And it's very much about, as the text puts it itself, divinity breathed into being, heaven and earth seeming to touch with music as the sort of outward expression of this meeting of the two worlds.
And then Sunday, 5 o'clock, and people can log on. I guess they need to log on ahead of time to make sure that they're in place for the concert at 5 o'clock on Sunday evening would be the plan, Mark.
It's actually 7 o'clock, I think, this Sunday. The last one was 5 o'clock. This Sunday's concert is 7 o'clock
right
in the evening.
All right.
And yes, and musicforgalway.ie has all the details of how to log in
musicforgalway.ie and double check the timing on that. That's Mark Dooley speaking to me about Sunday evening's performance then in the Abbond Music series taking place in St. Nicholas's Collegiate Church in the heart of Galway City. Not a Novel is the latest book from writer Jenny Erpenbeck, known particularly to Irish audiences for her novel The End of Days, which was shortlisted for the International Dublin Literary Award in 2016. Not a Novel is a collection of highly personal and poetic essays about life and literature, as well as a number of lectures Jenny has delivered over the years. And I'm delighted to have Jenny Erpenbeck speak with me this evening. I want to go to the very opening essay, in fact, in Not a Novel, Jenny. You were born in East Berlin in the 1960s. The wall was still in place. And as that first essay tells us, which has the great title, At the Ends of the Earth, the wall literally was at the bottom of your street.
Yeah, that's right. It was at the bottom of every street where I lived in Berlin at this time. So we moved three times, and each time it was the same. So I was very used to take the bus at the final station, and I was used to the silence, to the peaceful, quiet atmosphere in a dead end street.
And was it your parents who came up with this idea that you lived at the ends of the earth?
Actually, it's a saying in German that you use for describing something that is very far away or in a very remote place. And I thought it was funny because if you take it literally, saying the end of the world, and if there is a wall in the city, it's of course the end of your world, especially when you are a child.
You mentioned the kind of silence that you experienced in the area that you were living in those three different apartments and three different family homes over that period of time. What kind of presence was the wall then? Was it a benign presence? Was it a difficult presence, a frightening presence?
I think as a child, normally you take things as given. You can see that in documentaries about war or ruins somewhere else, you will always see the children playing. and not paying much attention at the things around, making the best of it, so to say. And for me, it was a given reality. I could even look down to the west from one of my family places where I lived. It was set like this, that there is a second reality existing beyond the wall that couldn't be reached. And I think this was an interesting experience because it was not the feeling of a loss, because for me there was nothing lost. I didn't know what was beyond the wall. I hadn't lost anything. I grew up with the half of Berlin that was a whole for me. It was more like realizing, aha, there are different realities that cannot be reached. You have to step back. You have to develop a certain kind of modesty. And this kind of thinking, I think, is very different from the philosophy of being a customer. Everything that you are paying for can be bought, and things have to be given to you because you are paying for these. It's a different thing. It's like more about stepping back and the conscience that not everything in the world is yours.
So it sounds to me, from the way you speak about it, you know, the story we get, I suppose the received story in terms of the wall is, and perhaps this is for the generation before you rather than your generation. You were born, the wall was in place, so you knew no other reality, I suppose, as a young child. But the story we're constantly told is this sense of loss, is this sense that, you know, over the wall was this great, wonderful place that was West Germany. You had no sense of that at all.
We knew a lot about it because we would watch the Western TV every evening. So we almost knew everything, I would say. It was not about not knowing. In some aspects, we considered us more progressive than the West. So in terms of like trying to motivate the people to really feel like the owners of the production, also in terms of women's rights, there were some things definitely more progressive than there were in the West. The products that we could see in the TV, of course, were nice. And some people really have had a longing for these things and wanted to consume all this wealthiness that they could see in the TV. But this was not, in my family, not the main question.
You were very close to your mother, and in her later years, she tried to make plans about exactly what would happen to her property. I was interested in the essay that you write about dealing with the aftermath of her death. You start listing out the things that actually would not have any inheritance tax attached to them. And these struck me as the things that had great value to you. What was that experience like, literally going through the material in your mother's apartment and itemizing it out in terms of the things that really meant something special to you?
Yeah, it was not so much the question which plans my mother had concerning the things that she would leave behind when one day she would pass away. It was more the question if values can be measured by money, or can have their find their expression in terms of money. So the government wants to know what you inherited, and this was something I was really irritated about, because the real values, or the things that seemed to me to have a real value, were things that kept memory, that kept time in themselves. The daily life I was sharing with my mom, the history that I was sharing with my mom, this was kept in tiny things that had no value at all in terms of money.
One of which receives a whole essay of its own, which is the pressure cooker that your mother had. Why did the pressure cooker hold so many memories?
Yeah, this is always the case. I wanted to get rid of the pressure cooker, because I don't know how to use such a thing. I was always afraid that it would explode, and I tried to get rid of it. And only in the moment when I tried how to get rid of it, and if I could perhaps bury it in our garden, I would realize that there's something special about this thing. And of course, it was the pressure cooker in which all the meals of my childhood had been cooked by my mom. And, you know, you remember how the it smelled, and how the daily routines of your childhood when you see such a thing. And then, of course, I realized that it is kind of weird to bury a pressure cooker. To tell someone about it. And
when your mother cooked cabbage stew in the pressure cooker, did the smell of cabbage invade the entire apartment, or did the pressure cooker in fact keep the smell inside?
No, it would smell everywhere, but always, so at least for me, it's like your own meals can smell, and it's a nice feeling. Only the meals of neighbors shouldn't smell. It's like an invisible, perhaps an invisible border. And it's, I think, in the smell, we know from Proust that in the smell, our earliest memories of feeling at home.
I suppose many people, when they think of East Germany, will think of films like The Lives of Others, and they'll think of stories of the Stasi's reign of terror in East Germany. Now, you seem to have had quite a benign experience when it comes to the Stasi. Tell me about John and the snooping that you think was done, or that you found out, in fact, was done on the correspondence between yourself and John.
Yeah, you will know the office in which you can apply to read your own Stasi files, so that you could find out who was spying you, and who was true, and who was a true friend or not, and also the reasons perhaps why they did so. And so I would apply one day to get my file, and my file was very thin. It was only 2 pages. I was not very interesting for the Stasi at this time. And one of the pages was written by a boy who had fallen in love with me in the holiday camp. And he, as a sign of his emphasis, he would sit in our house. It was a new building, a tall new building, 23 stores. And he would sit downside and write down all people that entered the house and left the house. He would write down all the persons, like saying a man, a woman with a dog, a girl, 2 boys or whatever. And this would be his present. And he put it into an envelope and into my mailbox. And the Stasi would take it off from the mailbox and find an observation text written by someone else who was not working for the Stasi, obviously, but only because of love for a girl.
Yeah, it did sound a little bit, however, as if John might have made a good Stasi himself in the area. I'll go to the to wrap into the section that deals with the many influences you have in terms of literature and music. I know you talked to us about your own great singing, but I'm particularly interested in why fairy tales, you feel, were so formative in terms of your own writing, and particularly the stories of the Brothers Grimm and the nastiness of them.
Yeah, they are nasty indeed. Especially nowadays, there's a tendency to clean everything, to make it politically correct, to use the right words, to take away all the cruelty and things like that, because parents normally think that these cruel and nasty and cold and spooky things perhaps wouldn't do some good for their children. I think the cruelty of the past was, of course, perhaps bigger than the cruelty in our lives is, because we have a modern health system and we are living in cities and so on. But the cruelty has a meaning, I think, which has a function also for if someone would write a fairy tale nowadays, he would never write such fairy tales as the Brother Grimm's collected in their fairy tales collection. And it's interesting to question that fact that in the past, stories like in which cruel things happen, like taking someone's eyes out, these stories were stories that were told not only the children, but also the adults. They were part of the daily life, and they were part of long winter evenings. And it was very common at this time. And it's interesting that we now think that things that are cruel cannot be told anymore to children, especially. All the things that happen under the surface should be kept from them. I'm still not finished with the thinking whether this is good or bad.
I suppose it is. It is a question that remains to be answered, whether it's a good or bad thing. Jenny Erpenbeck, thanks for speaking to us this evening.
Thank you.
Jenny Erpenbeck speaking to us there about her latest book, Not a Novel, Collected Writings and Reflections, which is published by Granta. Arena. 11 minutes to 8 on Monday night's Arena. Tulca is the Galway-based festival of visual art. The festival prides itself in making space for the visual arts to intersect with other disciplines. The Law is a White Dog is the title of this year's festival, and as that title suggests, the focus is on the law and how it impacts on our lives depending on who we are. Tulca this year comes in the form of podcasts and, when possible, exhibitions, as well as a limited edition book also called The Law is a White Dog. The curator is artist Sarah Brown, who has brought together artists and people involved in the law to create this year's festival. And she joins me now on the line. Let's start with that title. In fact, Sarah, The Law is a White Dog. Where does it come from?
Hi, Sean. The title itself comes from an amazing book by a legal academic called Colin Dyan. And the subtitle of the book is How Legal Rituals Make and Unmake Persons. So in that book, Colin Dyan is really talking about a history of legal personhood and how certain categorizations of people and their distance or their proximity from animals, such as dogs, kind of leads to different rights, but also different harms, and how people are confined. So she's particularly talking about the USA. And I was really interested in how some of these themes might map onto or might have some kind of resonance in the West of Ireland.
I mean, specifically, she's looking at this idea that you can be given a legal class almost, which then determines the rights that are there for you. If you're classed as a slave, you effectively have no rights, that type of idea.
That's it, exactly. So I guess who even gets to be considered a person in law, who is recognised, who's listened to, or who, like, issues about disability and capacity are also quite a big part of what she's talking about, really. Who's thought to be, like, a reasonable person, or who experiences pain in certain ways. So slavery is certainly a big part of that, yeah.
And Dan's book then, as you say, explores the situation in the US. What kind of parallels did you find then with the Irish situation and the Irish legal system?
Well, I guess Tulca is really interesting in that every year a curator sets up a brief and then issues an invitation. So as much as I had certain artists in mind who I invited directly, this was also like a kind of a point of departure for artists to respond to. So they were also invited to think about, I guess, like making art as a kind of like a witnessing maybe, or an act of testimony, or kind of thinking through the book or those themes, even not the book exactly, in quite creative ways. So some of the artists engage with law very directly. There's a project by Feli Speaks and Vukasin Nedeljevic that looks at, it's a billboard installation, and it addresses the history, well, the situation of direct provision in Ireland and an appeal to end it. And then other responses from the festival are much more oblique and kind of come through sculpture, painting, music, all kinds of different responses, actually.
And indeed, in the book itself, The Law is a White Dog, your own essay at the beginning of that talks about the tally stick or the bat is scored. Explain exactly what that was and where that fits into this sort of exploration that you're having throughout the exhibitions.
Yeah, I guess with the project in general, I was really interested to bring artists in contact with an audience as well, into contact with artifacts as well as artworks, and to bring law as a kind of a reference point into the imagination. So it was an artist, Monica de Bath, and also Gareth Kennedy, who brought this object of the tally stick to my attention, which are objects collected by the Museum of Country Life in Mayo. And these very small, humble objects are called tally sticks. They bear a series of marks, and they were mainly used in the 19th century by people who were illiterate or who enumerate to keep track of time or to keep track of certain acts. So one of the main ways they're used was by labourers, and sometimes they became a kind of a witness statement in court. But very sadly, they were also worn around children's necks. And if a child spoke Irish sometime, the stick would be marked, and that mark on the stick would correspond to a later punishment, sometimes by the same stick.
Wow.
So they seem to carry a lot of these ideas about landscape and language and punishment all in a very condensed form.
Yeah, I certainly had heard the Bath of Score in association with the penal laws, and this idea, if you spoke Irish, you got the mark on the stick. And as you said then, a certain number of marks meant the stick came off from around your neck and was then used to punish you. But you also mentioned about this idea of the stick being used as a way of maybe for illiterate labourers to mark down the number of hours that they worked. And they could be used then, the sticks could be used as evidence, the Bath of Score could be used as evidence in court.
Yeah, there are some accounts of labourers kind of bringing them to the magistrate and trusting that the judge would listen to them, and that the stick would sometimes be split in half and would be marked by both parties at the same time. So for me, I guess I am also interested in that kind of potential and that trust in the law, that different people can kind of speak through objects in different ways or use different kinds of languages to be heard by law.
Let's go to a piece then that directly addresses language, an artist called A.M. Baggs. And we're hearing this through the podcast form on tulka.ie. Explain what we see in this video.
This video is made by A.M. Baggs, as you said, who is known also as Amanda Baggs or Mel Baggs or Amelia E. Voicey Baggs, who died this year. And they were a disability rights activist who came to a lot of attention, particularly through this video. And in the first part of the video, you hear them kind of singing to their surroundings and interacting with objects in different ways that might be quite unfamiliar. And then in the second part of the video, you hear them, they don't speak. So the set of subtitles appears, and the subtitles is a rendition of this synthesized computer voice that I think we'll hear now.
Yeah, we'll have a listen to a little section. This is the second part. We've seen a series of gestures and sounds in the first part of the video, and then we see exactly the same gestures, but this time around the sound is this computerized translation, if you like.
We are even viewed as non-communicative if we don't speak the standard language. But other people are not considered non-communicative if they are so oblivious to our own languages as to believe they don't exist. In the end, I want you to know that this has not been intended as a voyeuristic freak show where you get to look at the bizarre workings of the autistic mind. It is meant as a strong statement on the existence and value of many different kinds of thinking and interaction in a world where how close you can appear to a specific one.
So a little clip there from A.M. Baggs' work In My Language, which is part of this year's Tulka exhibition. And speaking with me this evening is Sarah Brown, the curator of this year's Tulka. Another piece that you might tell us a little bit about is Rory Pilgrim.
Yeah, Rory Pilgrim, I guess their work is present in lots of different ways in Tulka, and that's been something, I suppose, that the pandemic has encouraged us to do, to think through many different senses, including like audio for a visual art festival. The piece that is in the festival is called The Undercurrent. It's a film made with a group of youth climate activists who are, I guess, subjects partly excluded from law because they're too young to be like recognised as having full rights yet. And the film is made in a very beautiful way through a series of songs that kind of weave these themes about law and climate justice into other concerns about spirituality and gender recognition, family, homelessness, all these kind of very huge emotional themes become funneled into these songs that form the background of the film.
Well, I'll finish up by listening to a little bit of one of those songs, but briefly then, the book itself, which takes the exhibition title as its own title, that's available. Mm-hmm. If you go to tulka.ie, you can find out all the details there, Sarah.
It is, and the podcast and also a series of online artist talks are accessible on the website.
All right. Well, I'll give that website out again before the end of the programme. But in the meantime, let's listen to a little bit of Rory Pilgrim and a song from that called Maximum Crisis, Maximum Calm.
'Cause I wanna feel, I wanna feel, I wanna feel. 'Cause I wanna feel, I wanna feel, I wanna feel. Maximum crisis and maximum call to maximum recover to the earth, our mother.
There we go. That's Rory Pilgrim. A little clip from that Maximum Crisis. Yes, Maximum Crisis, Maximum Calm. I thought there was minimum in there somewhere. At any rate, that was Sarah Brown speaking to us about Tulka before that and the title of this year's festival and the book, The Law is a White Dog. You can find out full details on tulka.ie. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Anne-Marie Dunn was the broadcast coordinator. Liam Murphy was the researcher this evening. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound supervision. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night.